Hello, and welcome to the Language of Mindfulness podcast. This is a podcast for people who want to have more great conversations in your life. You want to connect, you want to speak authentically, and you want to listen deeply. This is how to do it, and it's the real deal. So why should you listen to the Language of Mindfulness? Because in every episode, I'm going to give you tips and guidance I've learned in my pretty extensive career of coaching and practice from the best and brightest in the field of interpersonal communications, public speaking, meditation, group leadership, and somatic psychology. And we're going to have interviews with some amazing people about their groundbreaking work. It's my goal to give actionable and uncommon tips and advice in every episode that you can implement right away. So subscribe or follow now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And if you don't listen, you're going to miss some great stuff that you just won't hear anywhere else. I'm your host, Brett Hill, and welcome to the Language of Mindfulness. I'm really excited to welcome to the show today, Jonathan Reynolds. Jonathan Reynolds is the founder and CEO of Mindful Life, Mindful Work, Inc., a San Francisco-based leadership development company providing services that address the intersection of self-awareness and team performance. Since 1997, Jonathan has trained extensively in the discipline of mindfulness, and his work with leaders emphasizes simple and practical ways to improve performance, efficiency, and workplace cultures by integrating mindfulness sensibilities. So, like I said, I'm really happy to welcome to the show Jonathan, who's been doing some great work in the field of mindfulness, and particularly as it intersects organizational structures and adoption.
Great to be here, Brett. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. I've been so impressed with the work that you're doing. Mostly I track you via LinkedIn because I think you have a pretty strong presence there. And, you know, you guys have a good social media thing going on, and you got your conferences going on, your training going. There's just a lot going on in your world. Tell us a little bit about the mission. Like, what brought you into the vision of Mindful Life, Mindful Work, and the rocket ship that I think you're on since particularly the last couple of years?
Thanks for the question. You know, I really got into mindfulness for my own personal growth, and really because I was having a hard time in my early 20s. I was looking for a means to have a smoother ride through this life, and so looking for skills, looking for tools, and it really started with my own practice in the 90s. And then over time, of course, the natural sort of impetus is then to want to share what worked for us. So started teaching a little bit, and that transition then brought me through being a psychotherapist for a few years, and then to coaching. And really, for the last 12 years, have been focused on leadership development coaching in the corporate space. And then out of my own practice, Mindful Life, Mindful Work has grown organically. Initially, it was more like a collective. I was bringing in folks that had complementary and related services to be able to scale the conversations that I was in. And then over the years, we became more codified. And I think it's about 4 years ago now, we formed it into a C Corp. And in that process, went from coaching individuals to trainings to assessments to consulting. And we've been really fortunate. I mean, I know the last 2 years have been challenging for most folks, but even pre-COVID, Mindful Life, Mindful Work services were all delivered remotely. And so so the shift for us was more a shift in, oh, the world is now sort of appreciating this other way of working. And it's been difficult for all of us. So during that time, we also built out a public programs element, which is some of the events, I think, that brought us together initially.
Yeah. So, right there. And let's talk about that for them. You have just a networking thing, you call it, and that's been very popular. So how did that come into being, and tell us about that?
Well, the networking group was meeting in person pre-COVID, and there were small little sessions here in Northern California, just north of San Francisco in Marin County. And, you know, I mean,
like 10, in-person sessions or online?
Yeah, there were in-person sessions initially. Mm-hmm. There were 10, 20 folks come and do a little practice together and then discuss a topic as a way just to stay active in the community and to you know, grow in that way. But when COVID hit, of course, those were on pause, and was curious about how this could scale, how this could be a little more worldly. And so the networking sessions grew out of that. And the other thing that they were is they were a way to scale these sorts of conversations. I mean, it's podcasts, it's networking events. It's great to talk one-on-one, but if you can talk to 500 people at once, and if everybody can do that, and I can really cross-pollinate my own network, then that's what this is all about. This is really about creating that net or that web that is a family effort, a community effort. So the networking events just grew organically and have been really well received and a lot of fun.
So so people can sign up for these networking events and they don't need any kind of membership, and it's not like a big entry price or anything?
No, the cost for the events is $10 USD per event, and anybody can come. It's geared towards mindful leadership and those things related. But as you know, being at the events, we get folks from corporate America, but we also get providers of services. So it's really just sort of a nice marketplace, really, for everybody to hear about new ideas, to cross-pollinate, to learn from each other. And the other thing that I think is really unique about the events is we don't have speakers. We don't have sort of a central figure that's sort of showcased and the superstar. It really just is bare bones platform to get people into small breakout rooms on Zoom, you know, 5 to 6 people really hearing about each other's lives and work. I think that's what's fun.
Yeah, I do too. And I've enjoyed, I think I've been to every single one of them, and I have really enjoyed them. And I want to encourage our listeners who are interested, if you're in the mindfulness field at all, or even interested, you know, check it out and meet some really great people that way. You never know who you're going to meet, based on my experience. And that's really fun, because I really enjoy just the opportunity to just hear and see what people are up to, because there's so many people doing interesting and great work that you would never meet otherwise. So it's so thank you for that. But now let's back up just a little bit, because I'm really curious about, you know, you said you were just trying to learn, you wanted to learn mindfulness just to navigate your own life. Can you fill that out a little bit? Like, how did you first discover mindfulness as a possible solution or asset for you to learn?
Well, after I graduated from college, I was basically in an existential crisis, like many young people are. And I looked in the mirror and said, well, if learning how to balance my checkbook and drive a car is all there is to life, it's going to be a very boring and sad 80 years. And I didn't want that. I thought, well, geez, if just learning these basic skills is all there is, boy, this is not going to be a good ride. And so I went looking, like, there's got to be, you know, I wasn't thinking in terms of excellence, but sort of, you know, human potential movement stuff. Like, oh, like, how do you actually develop as a human being? How do you actually develop and shine? How do you live your best life? And now that's a common phrase. But even 25 years ago in the Midwest, where I grew up, I didn't really have models. And not that they didn't exist, they just weren't in front of me, or I wasn't able to see them at the time.
Yeah, we don't celebrate them very much in this culture, actually, from what I can tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, so for me, it was a breath of fresh air that I could actually cultivate a more skillful way, you know, a way that actually had effects on the outcomes and the results in my day-to-day. Yeah, it was revolutionary for me at the time.
And so what did you encounter? Was it Jon Kabat-Zinn's work, or what was your first kind of... I should check this out. Was it meditation? I mean, a lot of people encounter some kind of a meditational path, and then they transition to mindfulness, which was my path. And other people do it another way.
You know, I came a little bit through the self-help door and a little bit through the psychology door. Some of the early things that I read was like He, She, and We by Robert Johnson, some of those books. And then I came upon Charles Tart, Waking Up. And then really my first sort of mindfulness proper was Thich Nhat Hanh and Joko Beck, you know, things like Everyday Zen and Plum Village Meditations, The Meaning of Mindfulness, all of those sorts of things. And I really began practicing right away. Like I was really hungry. So, you know, things like yoga and things like meditation were very early on in my sort of practice life, because again, I was trying to heal sort of I don't know if I call it sort of generational trauma or anything that profound, but it really did sort of live in my body in that way, whether that was cultural or my own birth family, or just sort of my natural arc and predisposition as a person. I was just hungry for relief. And so once I tasted a little bit of freedom and a little bit of relief from sort of rigidity or calcification, I was ready to go. Like it was, I was just like one time and I wasn't turning back because I really felt like there's real value here.
And did you then like take up a particular, was this all self-directed or did you go to, or did you line up with a school and a teaching or just, I'm just curious.
Mostly for the first 8 years, it was primarily self-directed. And I felt like I knew, you know, like a plant reaching for the sun, that's called a tropism in biology. I knew how to check in with myself and I knew what felt like right and true and honest and had integrity and what didn't. And so, you know, I did a lot of dabbling, a lot of just playing around with the marketplace of mindful practices, and really sort of fell into concentration meditation practices early on. What are sometimes called absorption practices, you know, really concentration to the exclusion of external stimulus, because I needed to clean things up. I once heard somebody say, oh, it felt like brainwashing. Well, my brain needed to be washed. And so, yeah.
Good idea to clean the pipe sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, I needed a reset. And it was a really skillful, I think, and useful way to do that. And very early on, maybe even a little too early, I started teaching mindfulness in various expressions, had individual clients, had small groups that I was leading. Yeah, I just jumped in both feet because it just felt right.
And when you graduated, you said you had come from a therapy background. So did you have a degree in psychology or social work or some background?
My undergraduate degree was in biology. And so that was, so it was after the biology degree, I went to Lawrence University, a small private school in Appleton, Wisconsin, and then spent several years developing the mindfulness piece and then went back and got my psychology degree, over a decade later. And trained and got licensed to be an MFT, a marriage and family therapist. I'm still licensed, but my license is in active mode, whatever that means. It means I can't practice.
Right. So I'm curious if you found that your training was aligned with your other, you know, your passion, your work of passion to, like, you know, basically what I would call just wake up to kind of who you are and the world around us and plug into something bigger, which it sounds like you had some success in doing. And then when you went to school, then did you feel like that you were enhancing your learning or was that kind of like driving backwards? Because the teaching wasn't really aligned with the kinds of things you'd already learned?
Well, it depends on in what stage. I mean, what happened was, is after I graduated with a degree in biology, I went to UW-Madison and was a special student there, meaning a non-degree student, studied philosophy for a couple of years, and was really interested in filling out sort of, at least seeing different models. Because for me, it really was about integrating and connecting. I mean, the biology was still there. It was wanting to align myself with what was most natural. So for me, it was sort of a leaning towards simplicity. I mean, really, even more foundational than mindfulness in my life has been simplicity. And when you sort of take away, when you practice Occam's razor and get rid of what's not needed, what's left over? Well, what's left over is pretty darn peaceful and clear and simple. And so mindfulness was a way to engage with that and practice with that, cultivate that and live that to whatever degree and in any given moment that's possible.
That's beautiful. I saw an internet meme today that was said a quote attributed to Alan Watson. It said, "The best way to deal with a glass of muddy water is to leave it alone." You know, it's like let things settle, right? So I'm hearing some of that, like just the simplicity of just letting things become clear is in our deep personal commitment to finding what is true. I'm rephrasing a little bit here, but it just strikes me as jumping out as having really informed you. Am I wrong about that?
Well, you know, I think I was very fortunate. And I say that because very early on in my practice, I recognized that looking for truth, seeking is not finding. And I recognized very early on that rather than looking for truth, to cultivate the practice of looking from truth. And for me, that's a mindfulness shift, getting into, as sometimes I say, live your life in the first person. So many folks live their life sort of in the third person, or sort of like they're reading a story about somebody, but it's them. And for me, very early on, whatever needed to bump got bumped in a way. You know, there was a time actually during my sort of most depressed, when I was having a hard time and hadn't yet found mindfulness, when I was drawing a lot. And I was really interested in art in negative space, the space between objects. And I was drawing sort of an infinite regress of me drawing on a notebook in an infinite regress. And that all of a sudden bumped me out in a way that I was like, oh, I'm really interested in the pure subjectivity of my experience. And I never got into non-dual teachers, like Douglas Harding wrote a book called The Headless Way, which is really interesting. We never see our own head except in the mirror, right? So if you're really embedded in first-person perspective, this almost doesn't exist in your reality because you never see it directly. You see it sort of sideways in a mirror or something. But that always really meant a lot to me, to really embed in that first-person perspective. For me, I found mindfulness a really supportive tool in cultivating that. And because of that, very liberating and very confidence and resilience supporting. I think it's what it's allowed me to sort of take what others might see as risks. I don't really see those as risks. And so I try to convey that, or cultivate that, or support the emergence of that in my clients. And I think I've found somewhat success in doing so.
Oh, that's really beautifully said. So you went to school and you did some research and what is true, and you began to dive deeply into that. You found some teachings that you aligned with and that really helped you kind of peel the onion a little bit, if I could just paraphrase, and get to something substantial, feels like. You went back later and got your degree, and now you moved forward to establish Mindful Life, Mindful Work. So how did you get from that place to building an organization that's focused on organizations?
I almost don't have an answer to that question in retrospect. I can sort, you know, it's sort of like watching a plane fly through the air, right? Like it looks like there's a path because there's a trail of smoke, but they're just flying all over the place, you know? And you know, in retrospect, and so a lot of trial and error, a lot of sort of lean startup principles around MVP, minimum viable product, and iteration, and trying what works and seeing what sticks. And you know, the alignment around the integrity and the quality and sort of the wanting to be useful and helpful in the world was always there. But then there was a dance, you know. I mean, 20 years ago, it was life coaching and spiritual coaching and practice coaching and all sorts of stuff. And then it got a little closer to organizations. It was career coaching and leadership, and then leadership development and executive coaching and things like this. And so it just started growing in that direction. And then really over the last, again, 3 or 4 years, it's like, oh, it's assessments. Assessments are really important. Consulting. We have some expertise. We have some people with between 15 and 45 years of mindfulness experience on our team. Like, oh, we need to bring in this consulting piece. Coaching is really sort of, you know, drawing another person's best self out of themselves. And so we've got really good listeners. And mindfulness, I think, lets someone, as you know, and language of the mindfulness is listening for the subtle, conveying the subtle, speaking in a way that conveys care and integrity, you know, being selective with how we say things, all super important. And then the training piece, we're always building out trainings and having partnerships with other organizations around training. This is really a work in progress, and I like it. It's really an emergent element. We have vision, but we also are really open-minded, I think, and I think that served us really well.
So you're just, it's simply growing by virtue of what is presented as needed and just kind of saying yes to the emergent requirements and opportunities. That's so perfect in a million ways.
It's growing because we're consistent in our messaging and we're patient. And what happens with most folks is they either aren't clear on their messaging, and so then people can't reliably depend on them and trust them. Or they're consistent on their messaging, but they're impatient and they force it and they break it open like a hatching chick. You know, you gotta, so,
Can I put you on the spot about your messaging? Like, can you tell us what is that, the core of that?
I think the core of it is integrity and care. I really do. I think that, you know, there's a professionalism without being rigid. There's a warmth without being mushy. There's nothing wrong with those extremes. I have no problem with them personally. But when you're trying to create a safe place for other organizations and other professionals to arrive, it's really important to strike that balance. And that's a tricky balance. You know, I think one of the things Mindful Life, Mindful Work's done really well is we're not focused on self-improvement to the exclusion of organizational and systemic robustness. But we also aren't the other direction at all either. We're not focused on sort of organizational get business done to the exclusion of caring about people. I think we don't really even see those as two different endeavors. We see that the development of the company and the development and support of every employee is the same project. And equally the same project. And we tend to go through the L&D door rather than the HR door, but we're not against the HR door. It's all about, like, how do you want to position the value? What is the real value proposition? And then how do you convey that in a way that folks at all different levels can really resonate with that? I think that's the communication piece has been, I think, our biggest win.
And the communication piece being how you communicate the organizational benefit as well as the interpersonal, the intra and interpersonal benefit, or the overall trust and stability aspect you were just talking about.
I think all of it. I think word choice is really important to convey that you know, have some knowledge in an area without saying you have knowledge in that area. and that, you know, I mean, and again, so everything's very carefully crafted. And I think that, you know, it's like when you pick up a book that's really well designed, you almost don't have to open the book to just feel the love that's been put into that book.
Exactly.
Whereas something that's just been slapped together by somebody and a famous person's name been put on it, you can just feel it's sort of flimsy energetically. And so I just think we haven't done that. We've just said, hey, we love what we do. Team is awesome. I love my team. And not that we would necessarily do it forever if we weren't able to make a living doing it, but pretty close. And people feel that. People feel that you're really committed, and we're really committed. So and it feels good. It's like it makes it easier to sleep at night when you're true to yourself.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and so I'm wondering about the kinds of, when companies come to you, are they looking, are they saying, oh, I've read about how mindfulness helps? I mean, what's the pain switch? What's the motive? What's the draw that gets the company to pick up the phone and call you? What are you hearing?
It's different every time. It is sort of a management consulting model in that we want to hear what the challenges actually are. We want to be responsive. We have lots of tools. I mean, we in some ways feel like we almost have infinite tools. So it's like we need to hear what the problem. It's just like going to the doctor. Go to the doctor sometime and tell them, don't tell them where it hurts and see if they can find it. The only reason the doctor is the expert is you say, my elbow hurts, and they go right there and say, yeah, your elbow hurts. So it's the same sort of thing. We don't want to show up and assume that we know what a company needs, because we don't. Until we really build that relationship in here. And we weren't offering anything with the word mindfulness in it, or mindfulness proper, until a couple of years ago when we acquired a Boston-based company. I think we're Mindful Life, Mindful Work, and we very carefully chose that because we also didn't want to pigeonhole ourselves. Mindful means lots of different things to lots of different people, as does mindfulness, but mindful even more so. So part of that languaging is, again, not shaming someone or making them feel like they don't know, including individuals and also companies, so we can go in and really build a relationship of trust. And then we can find out, well, can we help you? And do you want us to help you? I think that's been sort of the secret sauce, is that at our core, we're relationship experts. We're not mindfulness experts. We get a lot of mindfulness experience, but we're about people and relationships. In fact, I in my BD, in my business development, I'm often, you know, talking to somebody at a company and they say, oh, sorry, I moved companies. I say, I wasn't interested in the company. I'm interested in you. Exactly. I mean, wherever you go, maybe we'll get some work at that company. But I'm actually interested in the interpersonal relationship, because that's where the trust and the alignment is. And that can grow into a company, and should, of course. But we're not targeting specific companies that we feel like we need to work for. We're growing relationships with people. And the networking event is sort of an offshoot of that. Like, let's talk to the maximum amount of people and see what happens.
Nice. So really you're saying you somehow got a conversation going, and then you're just going to go in and listen and see what is needed to determine if there's a fit here. And really, I love the fact that you name it's really about relationships, because that's, of course, where I live as well. And even when I was doing IT, and one of the things I talk about in technology is that technology is a person business, it's a people business that everyone forgets somehow, and I think to their detriment. So it lights me up to hear you say that, because I personally am very committed to that in my own work, and in emphasizing that in the work with others as well. And that is no doubt one of the reasons you're having some success. So how are things going for Mindful Life, Mindful Work? You know, you started off with kind of, I guess we're doing organizations now, because that's what's coming to us. And now where are you? Like, what's the trajectory for you from here?
You know, things are looking really good, although things have been slow over COVID. You know, even though organizations are coming into sort of this remote world, they're also being very careful with budgets. And I think that's a smart decision. I think that... you know, it's when to put dollars towards something when you sort of see that the rocket or the trajectory can take off. And I think COVID is still enough of an uncertainty that I think organizations should be very careful with their spending. Worst case scenario is organizations start to disappear. And some of that has happened with ones that have overextended. And so that's not great for us that they're careful with spending, but I think it's great longer term. And so seeing that long game. That said, over the last year, we've been in some of the biggest conversations that we've been in. Most of those sales cycles are minimum 18 months. And so those big, big engagements aren't closing these days. But we're hopeful for 2022, and maybe even towards the end of this year, some of that will sort of resolve itself. It's part of the reason to have sort of a multi-tiered engagement is that, you know, you strengthen sort of the overall stability. When the big stuff isn't closing, some of the smaller stuff can sort of help you through, and vice versa. You know, when some of the smaller stuff sort of dries up, then, you know, one or two big ones can be enough. And again, we're designed very lean. We're designed not to be too top heavy. We're very organic. And that has served us well, because we don't have a lot of pressure on us. We can really pick clients. We don't have to just work with anybody. We can be selective, and that's where you want to be, I think.
So, that's great to hear. And you sound so resilient in the capacity to kind of adapt. I mean, that seems to be showing up as a theme here. This adaptive capability, So like, you know, COVID comes and you're already running remote, and you're lean and you're adaptive. So that gives you a ton of responsiveness and response ability, so to speak. I'm curious about what you think. Do you have an idea about where mindfulness in organizations is going? Are you seeing bigger, a more willingness, a readiness to engage that conversation? What are your thoughts on that?
I think the companies are more open these days because they're really recognizing that they could lose all of their employees. I think for the first time, companies are realizing that not only do they pick employees, but employees pick them, and that employees can re-choose, especially now that you can work for any company remotely, pretty much, that people aren't willing to put up with too much garbage. And so I think that is sort of a buyer's market for employees. And I think that's really good because I think it sort of forces companies to make sure that they're treating folks in a humane way. And I think mindfulness is a really great way to do that. But again, it's a tool. You can use a hammer to build a house, or you can break all the windows in the house with the hammer. And so it really is how it's used. It can be used in really basic ways, just as sort of a perk. You get a couple of mindfulness sessions as an EAP sort of thing. Or it can be a whole cultural overhaul. It all depends. And we've seen all sorts of stuff. We've seen folks that are in real deep that already have their own programs and bring us in and just want to sort of augment because they already got the ball rolling. We've got places that have, you know, just heard the word mindfulness yesterday and said, hey, this sounds like we should be doing this, and everybody in between. And so the thing that I'm really happy about is that it's happening, is that the conversation is happening. How much regulation or sort of like quality of services we'll have to get online to ensure quality delivery, a lot of that I just trust. A lot of that, personally, that however somebody gets in, they'll sort of up their need for more refined versions and things like that. And I'd like to think we're a more refined version than a lot of versions as far as mindful services. But again, a lot of me just trusts that that'll take care of itself and people will find the right level. That's been my experience. And the reason I like acting in that way or living in that way is it's just a lot easier on my heart to trust. I don't want to police any of this. Every once in a while, there's something that sort of does need to be put in check. Pretty rare, but every once in a while, you know, I mean, for instance, I'm seeing a lot of conscious businesses from people that have apparently no history in conscious businesses. And that's, you know, that could be a little bit concerning. But again, most of that gets sorted out naturally, sort of in process. So it's not a huge red flag, but, you know, I think it's really important for anybody sort of that wants to step in and to provide mindful services to practice yourself, to practice for at least a few years and sort of, you know, have a relationship to the practice. Because that's where all the delivery comes from. That's where all of my services were born, out of my own relationship to practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so your ability to cultivate talent depends on finding people who have relationships to the practice that can also communicate and teach and instruct. And that's an important, I'm going to say, important task in the world, I think. And so you're saying that you think that it's a little bit more open, that businesses are picking up the phone and calling out of just random curiosity, like, oh, I read about that, that sounded good, or something deeper. But I wanted to ask you if you had engagements where you felt like things went really well, and if you could maybe, I guess what I'm reaching for here is, like, are there characteristics of an organization that is well equipped or aligned with making embedding mindfulness into not only individuals but as part of their corporate culture? Are there any sort of, like, well, I found that these kinds of organizations, this kind of orientation seems to help with adoption in more than just a pro forma sort of way? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, this isn't always the case, but often is their employee base younger? That's not always the case, but young people tend to be a little more open to change. Again, not always the case, but So there's that piece. So tech is often a place because often those companies are made up mostly of younger folks. Not always, again, but often. And so there's also sort of a size component. One is they got to be able to afford our services. So it's got to be big enough to have some budget, some expendable budget, discretionary spending. The other is it can't necessarily be too big, because then they'll just bring in their own L&D to create the thing. And so, so to guess at a sweet spot, 500 to 10,000 employees, somewhere in that range, maybe even 500 to 5,000, 10,000. But so again, sort of seeing, well, what is the delivery? What is the value? Is a company big enough that they could, well, and those bigger companies, we often offer like, oh, we'll sort of just be sort of the mindfulness add-on to your L&D. So sort of like an outboard mindfulness, like we'll help you develop some programmatic stuff.
And L&D for our listeners would be what
Learning and
specifically?
development.
Okay.
Yeah, and HR is human resources, of course. And so, and the reason L&D for us is because we want to be really clear that this is a business decision. This isn't just a human decision. It's, of course, the business is made up of humans, and so it's important to consider them. But this is also a numbers and a growing the company decision. And because of that, it takes a lot of education and care and sort of mapping out why this is a good decision. Why, and sometimes inaction is the worst thing. I mean, the part of me that loves inaction, like here's an example where inaction is not a good thing, is that the company that doesn't do it and then loses employees, or there's something festering that they're not actually inquiring about, which is almost always true. A community that isn't in disagreement is an unhealthy community. If you get enough people together, there's going to be disagreements. So if everything feels like it's going great and nobody's disagreeing, you've got a time bomb. Like there should be disagreements. That's part of being a group of humans. So I guess I just say all that because I think it's really important to hold sort of how this work gets delivered, how it's conveyed, how it's languaged, and then how it's implemented, how it's put in. There's got to be a lot of care there so people don't be feel called out for what they don't know, or they weren't doing it wrong. This is just an opportunity. I think psychological sensitivity, that's where my psychology training has really come in to this work, is how do you speak the language of another?
Well, that's yes, that's a super important function of conscious listening in a way is listening for the language of another person. And so I totally agree with you about with that. And that question of how do you do that is really a complicated question.
And it's really a process, right? I mean, there's no sort of exact recipe. We have protocols, we have stages, we have stuff that we do. And to really be available to what I call developing on the fly. Again, that's not a fake it till you make it. That's a responsive and, oh, how is this going to be different than it's ever been? Like in my individual engagements, I don't use assessments, I don't use forms, I don't use a system. I just say, hey, it's going to be psychological, individualized, and we don't know what it's going to be. I don't know, and you probably don't even know. The client doesn't even know, because once we get in there together, it's different. And
Yeah, every time.
that's where good, cool stuff comes out. And when you're in a system in an organization, again, how to go in and not be disruptive but supportive, and have that happen at a greater scale in a way that's healing, in a way that's useful, in a way that's better and more integrated. That's why I sometimes say it's like steering a 1,000-foot boat. It's not like steering a jet ski. You can't take a left the moment you want to. You got a plan to take a left in a big long boat. And same sort of thing with an organization. And so a lot of planning goes in, a lot of conversations. I mean, everything is assessment. There's formal assessments, but then every conversation is an assessment.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point of view, which I hadn't even considered actually, but it's true. Every time you have a conversation, there's an inner assessment, and when you have like a history or even a sequence of things, like particularly if you're working with a client or a company, it's kind of like, oh, we can assess over time how things are going just by the quality of conversation in a certain way. That's an interesting point of view. I wanted to ask about, you made the comment that this is a numbers game when talking to businesses. And I wanted to ask about that numbers game. And a couple of times you said something like, you know, mindfulness as a means to retain employees. So how does that work? How does the adoption or the implementation of mindfulness in an organization or as a personal practice help a company to have employees that want to stay there?
I think employees that are cared for and respected, you know, it's not always about how much money you're making. And lots of studies have come out that people will take a pay cut if they're in a place that they, you know, feel empathy for and received from. And so a lot of it, again, a lot of it is mindful life, mindful work as a company modeling this. You know, I mean, any training we give to a company, we've already run through ourselves usually. And so we are the first client ourselves. We're the client. And then giving that to, you know, client organizations. So a lot of it is conversations around that and really drilling in through a discovery session around what is the pain point. And they might say, oh, people are leaving. It's terrible. Well, why are people leaving? Have you asked? Have you really found out? Have you created a psychologically safe space where they'll really tell you? Or are they just going to use the same old excuse? I got a better opportunity. Or I got a place that pays me $3,000 more a year. That might be the reason, but it almost always is not. And so, you know, getting into those conversations and asking pointed questions around, you know, what is really going on here? And do you guys really want to solve it? Because sometimes a company won't want to solve it. They just want it to go away. And that usually doesn't work. It doesn't just go away until you solve the cause. Mm-hmm. You know, you can trim all the leaves off a tree. It doesn't cut down the tree. You got to cut down the tree at the base.
I see. So it helps because, like, I mean, you mentioned the empathy piece, and it's like feeling like they're at a place where there's a humanity involved rather than just a business negotiation with everything.
Well, and seeing that those are connected, and it's tricky though, because leaders have to consider both of those. If they're not considering both of those sort of in unison, they're doing one a disservice. And so how to consider both of those and be skillful in that way. And so in a discovery call, we really want to find out, oh, folks are stressed out. Well, how do you know they're stressed out? Oh, they tell me. Well, do they do anything particular that shows that they're stressed out? Are they sleeping through meetings or are they calling in sick all the time? I mean, like what is the real indicator? And then, oh, well, how are we going to respond to that from a leadership perspective, but then also from the employee perspective? How are we going to hold both of these in a way that it works out for folks and they're actually happy to show up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's beautifully said, I think, in the sense that with a business, you do have, you know, you've got business objectives. You've got to hit your marks. You've got production. You've got growth. And I think that what you just said is the key, and that's that businesses are realizing more than ever, and I totally agree with this, that there's a part of the business objective is the human aspect of working in this business. And if you succeed in all of your performance objectives, you're getting things done, your productivity and your numbers, and you fail at the other, that you're going to fail as an organization in the long run. And particularly in the modern world, because like you say, employees have choices these days that they didn't have before. And I'm seeing, I think, kind of a organizations like yours and others just be a lot more engaged by corporations and businesses to really kind of refactor themselves in a fundamental way, like you said, at the core. And that's extreme interest to me. And I'm just really, really happy that you're in this work and that you're doing such a great job of bringing life and heart and connection into a very practical engaged, accessible resource for people that they can engage to transform their organization. So on behalf of the business world, thank you very kindly for your work.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for your work. You know, it's part of what brings us kindred souls together is we're on the same project, but maybe going through a slightly different door, maybe not so much of a different door. But, you know, it's we support each other. We sustain each other. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to know you and to be on your show and to continue to grow together.
Yeah, thank you so much. Looking forward to that. How can people connect with Mindful Life, Mindful Work, and get engaged with what you're doing?
Well, you can always go to the website, www.mindfullifemindfulwork.com. We're all over social media. I just sent out a post earlier today around, you know, we're probably on 10 different platforms. We're trying to grow each platform to 1,000 followers. So, you know, LinkedIn is sort of our main hub, but we're on other ones because we want to just get in front of as many eyes as possible and continue to grow this. I mean, we really feel like we're just getting started, even though we have pretty good traction. I just think up and away from here.
Fabulous. Well, what's next? Do you guys have plans for the next, like, the quarters? You have events or something coming up that you want to call out?
Yeah, we have our Q4 strategic mindful strategy conversation. I think that's coming up early November. And then late December, we'll do our winter solstice networking event. Yeah, those are the two sort of public things coming up. I also have a training called the Business of Mindful Services coming up in October, which is 8 weeks for folks providing mindful services to sort of be in community, be in dialogue around 8 specific themes that I think are really important. But really, it'll be a process group. So whatever people bring, we'll work on.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for the conversation. It's a pleasure to chat with you as usual. And best wishes on your future plans and engagement with Mindful Life Mindful, personally and professionally.
Thank you so much, Brett. Same to you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. So that's a wrap on today's edition of the Language of Mindfulness podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it. If so, please leave us a review on iTunes and follow along on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. We'd really appreciate it. And check us out at languageofmindfulness.com, where you can sign up for a free coaching session. And because we get so many questions on this, you can access how to start a mindfulness meditation practice at languageofmindfulness.com/now. Thanks a ton, and we're looking forward to a lot of great new content coming up as well. Have a great one, and stay present. Thanks.